Hello, everybody, back with another Retro Pulp podcast. This time we're talking about the 1984 horror comedy Ghostbusters. Horror comedy might be... It's little kid scary, for sure. Real little kids scare this movie. I think as adults, we can all handle it.
Mm-hmm.
It's directed by Ivan Reitman, director of Meatballs, Twins, Kindergarten Cop, Junior, 6 Days, 7 Nights. Written by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis. Get to their IMDb here in a minute. Stars Bill Murray. Love him on Groundhog Day, Lost in Translation, also in Caddyshack. Dan Aykroyd, Blues Brothers, Trading Places, Gross Point Blank. Sigourney Weaver, famous from the Aliens franchise, Badass, Avatar, Gorillas in the Mist, Heartbreakers. Harold Ramis. Is it Raimi? Raimi's?
Ramis. Oh, yeah.
Stripes analyzed this. He wrote and directed Caddyshack and Groundhog Day. Ernie Hudson from The Crow, Congo, Miss Congeniality, Rick Moranis from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Strange Brew, Spaceballs, Little Shop of Horrors, Annie Potts, Pretty in Pink, voice of Bo Peep and the various Toy Stories. William Atherton plays just pieces of shit. He's the EPA guy in this. He's the slimy executive on Die Hard. The real life Larry King and Casey Kasem cameo in this. Apparently Ron Jeremy and Debbie Gibson are in this as well. I did not see either of them. I don't know. I ran out of research time to find out where they appeared. And here's one that blew my mind. The voice of Slimer, Ivan Reitman.
Okay. Director himself. Hmm.
So this is a beloved comedy classic. I remember when I was a kid, I was about 7 when this movie came out. All the kids at school loved it. Everybody wanted to be a Ghostbuster that Halloween. Everybody wanted to get the slime and slime everybody. It was so funny. I missed out on this because it's about supernatural scary things and my mom wouldn't let me watch it. And a lot of things, prohibitions, I found workarounds for my mom. You know, I could go watch Predator at my cousin's house and I could watch G.I. Joe at my neighbor's house. But I was unironically afraid of ghosts and demons growing up. So I steer clear of all of this stuff, you know, kind of on my own recognizance. So I was probably in my late 20s, maybe even early 30s before I've watched this movie. And I think I've only watched it all the way through once before. That's my history with the film. I'm wondering about yours, Jim.
I mean, a very similar boat. I was not unironically afraid of ghosts. I never really believed in that stuff. The scariest I got a ghost was watching The Exorcist and shit like that, and demons and whatnot. But somehow, I know how. It's because it was forbidden, but I really did not ever see this movie as a kid. And I think I missed a huge window here for me to be a massive fan of Ghostbusters, because it has, in my opinion, everything that you could want out of an 80s action kids movie comedy. It's kind of a perfect movie in a lot of ways, and I don't have the appreciation I feel like I should have given my generation for this fantastic film.
I think I broadly agree. I was kind of ready to come on this and be like, I don't understand what the buzz is. I don't understand why people like Ghostbusters, because I remember watching it, but it didn't really make that big of an impression. You know, it's been probably 10, 15 years since I've seen it. And I thought it'd be dated, and it kind of is in places. But yeah, the world building, it's just effortlessly cool.
Funny.
There's a perfect blend of like supernatural meets technology. The creature effects, the ghost effects are largely hold up. There's a few rough pieces of compositing and some rough stop motion, but most of that stuff works. It works at the adult level, at the kid level. There's a couple things where I don't think it fires on all cylinders, but like back in the middle of the 80s, this was a state-of-the-art literally comedy. I think this is the most expensive, most special effects on a comedy.
That makes sense.
The brainchild of the insane Dan Aykroyd as filtered through the more reasonable and sensible Harold Ramis. But yeah, it just kind of works. It's cool and it's funny and it doesn't overstay its welcome. It's got a killer soundtrack.
Yeah, one of the all-time great theme songs for sure. I mean, we can talk specifically about what makes that theme song great. The era that it was in, certainly. It had all the elements you wanted from an 80s theme song. But I recognize its brilliance and how good it is. I also have a hot take to drop on people when we get talking about what makes this movie good.
Oh, wow. I can't wait this because I thought your hot take was going to be I actually hate this movie. And I was like, oof, boy, that's going to be a
no.
harder one to defend. But
it would be.
I now a little bit more understand the love that people have for this franchise and why people get like, you know, people are excited about this Ghostbusters Frozen World or whatever. And I guess
Day After Tomorrow,
Afterlife.
Yeah.
And I just like, I'm like, oh, I guess they might be cool, but like, yeah, if you grew up as a Gen Xer and you didn't live in a weird Jehovah's Witness cult, no fucking shit you're ate up with this movie because it's a banger. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a perfect recipe for getting kids interested in a thing. And I mean, mm-hmm. The merchandising opportunities in this movie are endless and awesome. I don't want to sell it short. I don't want to say like, oh, it's a cynical cash grab by putting all this obvious like, one-to-one toy stuff in it, but everything from the vehicles to the props to the characters with their jumpsuits and the like
the home base playset,
the playsets, yes, like everything just seems perfectly made to sell toys, and it doesn't feel like they set out to make that movie like with the Ninja Turtles or something, right? We're like,
no,
oh yeah, we're gonna, or He-Man, right? Like we're gonna make
early,
this
like. You take Star Wars off the table. This has got to be one of the early live action toy video game crossover comic book cartoons. Like
one of the more successful.
They
I remember
to
the
try
toys.
To force it. Remember when they had like Rambo and Friends?
Oh God!
They
like, yeah.
But like this was the and they had the illegitimate Ghostbusters cartoon. Then the mm-hmm, real mm-hmm. Ghostbusters. They were actually the Ghostbusters, and they all had a toy line. And there's comic books and. I remember watching my cousin play Ghostbusters on his Commodore 64. They had the video games. It was like, yeah, like you could just immerse yourself in this world as a child.
Yeah. No, it's kind of perfect for that. So, it's kind of amazing. They made a Ghostbusters video game not too long ago, maybe in the 2000s, late 2000s, that was actually really good. It's kind of a one-to-one telling of this first Ghostbusters movie story, and I played a bunch of that, and it was awesome.
Like there's like it's like the game, even though this was at the dawn age of the video games, like you can see like all the different little mini games. Oh, here's the Hunt for the Ghost mini game, here's the Proton Pack mini game, Twitch reaction, you gotta trap it.
God, there's so many cool props, right? I mean, the Proton Pack is just the start of it, and that's probably the coolest, but the PKE
iconic
meters and the traps and
Ecto-1, which is a fucking hearse, which can we talk about how perfect that is as a squad car for the Ghostbusters
the
to show up in?
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's... I could go on and on. Like I said, I was shocked at how well the special effects continue to hold up. It's a rare... like maybe it's not rare. Maybe I'm just not familiar with her catalog. But like Sigourney Weaver is a no-shit sex pod. Hardly ever
coming
trades
off
on
Alien, that was
hardly
crazy,
ever,
right?
Hardly ever trades on that, and she is amazing as just a complete. She's a very attractive, sophisticated woman, and then she gets slutty when the demon's inside of her, and that's fun. I'm trying to think like it's this and like Heartbreakers where she really just plays like
Jennifer Love Hewitt. Yeah,
yeah, like oh my god, she has a killer body. She's got a model face, and she's not just ripping aliens apart with her bare hands or killing gorilla poachers
in
the Congo. She can. She can glam it up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the scenes that always stands out to me. And I don't know if that's... I'm trying to remember when I saw this for the first time.
I didn't
time.
See it as... Because I can absolutely think that her stepping out as the gatekeeper would have really blown my hair back as a young man.
Oh, yeah.
But it's still working at 47. Bill Murray at the height of his powers.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Thank you.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern, or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is reward unto itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. And now, back with more Bald Move.
All right, maybe we should get into my hot take.
Dan Aykroyd doesn't ruin the movie?
Yeah, that's a bonus.
Rick Moranis is, you know, doing just what he kind of needs to do. It's kind of everything comes together.
Playing an ancient dog man, yeah.
Yeah, do we want to talk about more generalities, or should we get right into it?
Should probably get into specifics.
Okay, let's. I want to do a plot breakdown for the people who, like us, were in a weird cult or born yesterday, frozen cavemen, all those things. So Ghostbusters is about a out-of-work team of parapsychologists and scientists that have the luck to hang their ghost-busting shingle out at the time of unprecedented paranormal activity in New York, as they track a increasingly sprawling, sinister, ghostly event that has the Big Apple in its thrall. It goes from Sigourney Weaver's kitchen to that's the plot. That's the plot. There's ghosts. These scientists show up with a bunch of fancy ghost-busting equipment. They bust them. They make money. There's montages. The threat escalates. There's an act with the big showdown. The Ghostbusters might die. They might not make it out of this movie alive. New York City might fall to the fiends. You never know. You'll have to watch the movie to see how it turns out. It's a brisk, 1 hour, 40 minute time? Feels like the perfect length. Never drags.
Nope.
Just moves right along.
Yeah, perfectly paced. Endlessly entertaining.
If this is where you want to take off, because we're going to get into spoilers from now on, you should check it out. I'm not aware that there's a place to watch this for free right now.
No, it's part of the AMC Plus subscription, but I find that AMC Plus doesn't always do ad-free stuff, and
they don't.
I have stopped watching AMC Plus because of it, because we're subscribed to Amazon Prime.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I saw that with limited interruption, and I'm like, ha, nope.
I'm not
so
gonna
rented it on Apple for $4.
Ads in my movie? Come on. All right. Where do you want to start with? Do you want to start with your hot take? Do you want to build up to this hot take?
Okay. Yeah, let's start with the hot take, because I'm curious to see what you make of it. I think that this movie is great on a lot of its merits, but the reason it's a classic is 90% because of Bill Murray. Bill Murray carries this movie.
I don't think that's a hot take. I think that's exactly right. And I think it's perfect. Structurally intended. I think that...
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
Harold Ramis and Dan Aykroyd are sneaky funny because they get to do like...
Yeah.
Harold Ramis at the end where he's like, I'm sorry, Ray. I'm terrified beyond the capacity of rational thought.
One of my favorite quotes. Like, in the most rationally spoken way ever.
He delivers that line like he delivers the first line in the movie about getting bread or something. And uh-huh. it's so... like. And it's like they are the straight men
to Bill Murray's lunatic.
That Bill yeah. Murray gets to be the lunatic that orbits around them. And like if Dan Aykroyd were doing all this shit, if mm-hmm. Harold Ramis was, you know, Harold Ramis is kind of the straight man and everything. But like if they were out, if they were in a competition, I don't think it would work. But letting everyone is stepping back and treating him like Larry Bird, let him distribute the yep. ball, let him take the ball in the big moments. It works perfectly.
You take him out of the movie, I don't think it's... I almost don't even think it's a success. I think it's this weird thing that doesn't have much comedy in it at all.
I'm trying to think if I can see... Because, like, the thing is like, Bill Murray gets all the great stuff. But uh-huh. it does feel written for Bill Murray, and it probably was, because these guys were all big, fast friends. Like, these guys have been working together since days of National Lampoon, since Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They, like, I think this thing was written just for Bill Murray. So it makes a lot of sense. I'm trying to think if someone else could, like, who else could play this role? I don't know. It'd be interesting to see Eddie Murphy do a take on this particular...
Okay, I could see it. He's a leading man in the way that Bill Murray is.
That's one of the criticisms I think you could level at this film. The Ernie Hudson is a bit of a token. You know, he's just a random guy off the street that happens to be black. So this isn't just a completely monolithically white mm-hmm. film. I think Eddie Murphy, like, but you have to have a really charismatic, funny man. Like, I don't think Chevy Chase could not do that. I don't think Chevy Chase could carry this role.
I think there are many people who would disagree with you, but I understand why you say that.
He's just not got that gear.
It's not the same kind of comedy. He it's weird that he embodies sort of a straight man in his comedy. I don't quite know yeah. how he does it, but people yeah. love his shtick. I think it's interesting that this is like the last thing that Bill Murray did. We talked
until Scrooge
just
right?
this week about the... Scrooge, yeah. And yeah. this is kind of the break, right? It's Ghostbusters, and then a few years, not entirely off. He did Little Shop of Horrors in there. He did a couple of other films
Another
that are
Ramis kind of collab, yeah.
Yeah, but then he comes back for Scrooged, and I forget exactly why. We recorded Scrooged a little while ago, and I was very drunk. but yeah, it's interesting to see that like this is kind of the last thing before his big quote unquote comeback for Scrooged.
Yeah, it's hiatus. I'll say this, okay, hot take on top of your hot take. The parts of the movie that have aged poorly are almost all revolving around Bill Murray. Because, like, it's pretty yikesy the way he is hitting as a college professor on the co-ed that's there to take the test. But that's it's an interesting thing to examine. Yeah. It's like, I'm not going to clutch my pearls about it. But it's like, obviously in 1985... college professors were just going to hit on the hot girls in their classes, and that's just the way it's going to happen. Like, they're not going to rape them, maybe, but they're going to apply a lot of pressure in the terms of, like, you can do this to get paid and get grades, and that was accepted enough to just have in a comedy in 1985. So that's
I mean, when you compare it, I mean, what did you say Ivan Reitman also did?
Oh, yeah, Meatballs,
yeah,
Animal
yeah, Meatballs
Planet,
is the one.
Or not Animal, like, Planet, Animal House, yeah, like, that's, like...
This is more acceptable than those movies, for sure.
But it's an interesting cultural barometer. Like, this wasn't ancient history, this was, like, 40 years ago, you know? We came of age in this environment.
I'm definitely watching this movie, because it opens with that, right? I mean, the very first scene...
Act, Bill Murray is a pervert, and then that kind of like goes away in the subsequent acts. But yeah, or the first Bill.
Yeah, I feel like it's a Dumb and Dumber thing where he totally redeems himself, at least a bit, you know, because he has this thing that he's, you know, Sigourney Weaver comes in as their first client, and he just immediately, I mean, the way he jumps over the railing to go talk to her when she comes in is the eagerness.
Surprisingly physicality. Like, I noticed that he, like, high school track and field vaults that son of a bitch and almost biffs it. He is, like, a half
almost
inch
hooks
away
his toe on it, yep.
From eating pavement. Yeah, yeah.
I love the energy that Bill Murray has in this movie. This is... You can feel Bill Murray enjoying being in this movie in a lot of ways that you can't in some of his other films. Like,
true.
And I don't know if that's because he's an actor and he needs to bring that to this role, or if he just genuinely felt this role. But when he's interacting with Sigourney Weaver, it's very like horn dog, ulterior motive, and it's on the face of it, right? I mean, there's no pretense even here. He's obviously
she's
hitting
a powerful
on her.
When she sees what's happened and she's like, you know, is not
that
threatened
helps.
By it. She is shutting it down effortlessly. Yeah.
And then when there's the transformation, right? When she becomes the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
And she's hitting on him. He's not just immediately, he's not taking advantage of that. And I felt like there was a redeeming quality to him in those moments that I'm like, well, he's hitting on people. But he's not going to
violate
it.
People's consent. Yeah.
Right. And so you get like a lighter version of the character there from those scenes than I feel like you could have gone with the beginning of this movie.
The shame is, as I was watching this with fresh eyes, I'm like, man, they spend so much time with him being this kind of horn dog sex pest. And I was craving more. Like, I think there's a montage they left on the table of like Ray and Egon testing out the equipment. Like, they talk about all the tests that did not, and it's probably a budget FX issue that they couldn't just do it. But, like, I could have used a 3 or 4 minute funny comedic scene of them trying out the proton packs and the traps and the meters. And that's like, man, you get a little bit of that when Ernie Hudson shows up and they're like, kind of like, here's how the trap works. But, like, every time they showed that stuff, I wanted to know more. I want to know more of the technical details. I want to know more about that, like, parapsychology, technology, scientist intersection. I think that's really tasty. And maybe it's good for them to leave you wanting more. But
I do wonder if Ghostbusters 2 deals more in depth with that. I don't recall. Yeah. I know I've seen that because I remember, you know, the painting and that guy and all that stuff. But, like... Mm-hmm. I don't remember really anything about that movie. I've seen it once.
Yeah, I would like to see that again, too. I kind of got a real hanker. I hear it's not as good, but it does have Bobby Brown and a really good soundtrack.
Okay.
But you know what I mean? Like, I just thought that every time they were showing the technology, I just wished I knew a little bit more about it. And, like, in the beginning of the movie, we see Bill Murray doing his horn dog scientist routine. We never get to see the straight side of it. Like, you know, Ray and Egon always show up after his experiment to co-ed is ending, or, you know, like we never get to see the legitimate side of this science, because you get
the
idea
they got
that
the grant. Yeah.
Venkman doesn't really believe in it. He just sees this as like the easiest way to get a doctor and
hit on like, attractive co-eds. Yeah.
And that line with where Ray is like, they're talking about they're getting thrown out of the university, and he's like, I've worked in a private sector, it's tough out there, they expect results. Like, there's just all this like really funny like takes at academia that I think are pretty funny. But I want to see the quote-unquote serious science, the lore of the Ghostbusters.
Yeah. Why were they able to get a grant in the first place? Simply because one of them has a couple of doctorates, or I don't know that a doctorate in parapsychology is a real thing. I'm certain that a doctorate in psychology is a real thing. I'm not sure if Venkman is lying about having one of those or if he does actually have it, but he's a professor, right? So he must.
Yeah. The other thing is, like, I think that like coming out of the 80s, maybe there were still like people taking shit like this serious. I think that we have kind of come of age in a more of an era of rationality. Maybe we're backsliding a bit, but maybe that you could have like people that took, like, certainly the turn of the century, people took this stuff very seriously. You know, you had like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle like actually hosting seances and you know, people investigating it and taking it kind of, and now we've got like ghost hunters on TV where they've got all the infrared cameras and all the gogglygook and sonic recorders. And
that turn of the century stuff is kind of why the plot of this movie works in a significant way, right? Because you've got that cult that kind of sets up everything that happens in this movie.
And that's the thing. There's a little bit of verisimilitude here because Dan Aykroyd unironically believes in this shit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his friend Harold Ramis like took his, because he wrote a whole treatise about like, you know, these characters going through time and space and doing paranormal stuff. And you really want to get it made. And Harold's like, okay, let me take this and translate Crazy Dan into mainstream success.
Yeah, yeah.
But like a lot of, and I was wondering like how much of like, is Zool like a real book, a real demon you could look up in like Aleister Crowley's, you know, some
Sumerian ancient text or something like, yeah.
Yeah. Some magical tome that he wrote. But like, there's a point in the movie where like Rick Moranis comes out and starts saying it sounds like Rick and Morty shit, like Floopity Flop, what came out of Boogertown. Mm-hmm. 1,000 years ago, and all the gozers and dozers then dozed themselves into a big steaming pile of floop. And I'm like, no, they're just making shit up. But there is enough of like someone on this project believed enough in this that knew about like ectoplasm and, you know, like what a class 5 parademon would look like. And it gives a little bit of like truthiness to the science fiction that I really liked. There's a little crunch to this stupid story about ghosts,
and a lot of really quotable parts of this movie revolve around that too. Like people who are really into Ghostbusters love to show off their fandom by quoting that speech in its entirety, right? That nonsense floopity flop stuff.
Yeah, yeah. The definition of end times and ends with Bill Murray
and cats and living dogs together. Living. Yeah,
it's funny because I feel like I was in your position with The Princess Bride with this movie, because watching this movie is like, oh, that's where that comes from. Oh, that's where that, like the terrified beyond capacity for rational thought. I've heard that a million times. A dozen of my friends have dashed that in conversation. I never knew where it came from.
Yeah.
We have the tools. We have the talent. That's another one that I've
back
heard
off,
people
man.
Try
I'm
out
a
before.
Scientist. That one's a good one.
Yep. It's good stuff.
One that's harder to use in everyday conversation, but cracks me up in the movie is, yes, it's true. This man has no dick.
We're talking about this guy being a dickless, this or that, and the mayor's like, is this true? It is true. This man has no dick. I think that line would be 50% funnier if he said penis, but yeah.
Calls him dickless.
I wish this movie could be PG-13 because they didn't have PG-13 back there. It's because the mother pus maker feels like you're watching a balderized made for TV version of Ghostbusters where Bill Murray says that towards the end.
Oh, I don't remember.
Clearly
that.
He's supposed to say motherfucker, but it's mother pus maker or something like that.
Weird.
Let the Ghostbusters say fuck, okay?
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of like that Twilight somewhere between kids movie and adult movie. Because the subject matter from time to time gets very adult. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's Sigourney Weaver saying you want this body is like something that kids look at and say, oh no, the ghost is like has her body. And the adults are like, oh yeah, they're going to fuck.
Well, and there's the key master and there's the gatekeeper, and one's a man and one's a
one's
woman.
When
they finally get together, they kiss and then they break up. And the next time you see, they get up from a stone table where they've obviously been having raw sex.
Yeah, his shirt's open, his hair's all mussed. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. But the 7-year-olds in the crowd have no idea. They just kissed, and you know that's how Mommy Ghost and Daddy Ghost makes a portal to hell.
Uh-huh.
It's
yeah, I
really,
like that in between. I really do.
And like I think, you know, like Dan Aykroyd gets a ghost blowy in the middle of this film, but in a way that I think sails over the kids' heads. Yeah, they did a really good job of putting in adult humor without it being gross, because they're obviously going for kids here too.
Yep, I agree. Speaking of kids stuff in this movie,
yeah,
one thing that I think as a kid I would have both loved and been terrified by is the like Pee-wee's Big Adventure style ghost scare at the beginning of this movie in the library.
Yeah.
It's on that level. It's not quite Large Marge, but it's really good scare when you don't expect it. And as a kid, I would have been terrified by that.
That's what I'm saying. This is right in the little kid scary zone, where anything younger than seven, there's going to be some scenes where the kids are going to crawl up your lap. Like, there's this very scary kind of ghost with like two psi arms that comes out of a subway at some point. I thought the library ghost fully manifested was scary, especially since as a kid, I remember bracing for the ghost and he's, oh, it's an old lady ghost. That's not going to be that scary. Then you piss her off and she transforms into the actual scary ghost. But most of the stuff is goofy, like the gatekeeper and the keymaster. When they're running around, they look like dopey dogs. Slimer is just reads as hilarious.
And then Stay Puft, obviously.
Stay Puft,
great, iconic. It's amazing.
It's so brilliant because it starts off funny. This giant 100-foot-tall marshmallow man, and but yet like. When he gets hurt and he gets pissed off, his little stink face that he makes is fucking hilarious.
Yep.
And then the concept of a marshmallow man on fire climbing a building, as you can see his marshmallow toasting and there's rivulets of mallow running down his armpits and stuff. It's just really funny and kind of horrific. Like, this is a thing made out of molten sugar and it's going to kill you.
Oh, yeah. When it drops down on... Prick or Peck or whatever his name is. I was like, oh, that guy's in a world of pain right now. You better uncover him because he can't breathe, A. And B, that stuff's probably being pretty hot.
Can you imagine being covered to that depth of marshmallow foam? It might suffocate you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it could easily kill you. And the other thing I like about the Stay Puft guy is the way that he's conjured. It's like everybody's, you know, okay, so... We get to choose our fate here, you know, the thing that's going to destroy us. Don't think about anything. And everybody's successful at not thinking about anything, except for Stance, Ray, who's just like this kind of dumb engineer guy. I mean, he's smart, obviously, because he's making all this equipment and stuff with Ramus, but he's also kind of a dummy, and he conjures...
His people skills might be a little on the spectrum, yeah.
Yeah, and he conjures up the thing that he thinks is going to be least offensive. And turns out it's still a monster, right? Because it's still sent to destroy you.
Yeah, whatever shape it is, it's going to destroy you, so...
Uh-huh.
But it's a very funny... Okay. Here, I'm trying to armchair quarterback a 40-year-old comedy. I thought they could have done the reveal of Stay Puft. I felt like they fucked up the beat, the punchline. Like, they have Ray kind of stammering about trying to keep a brain, and I'm like, I try to do that, try to do that, and then you hear the footsteps, and then they cut to the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, and then they cut back, and Ray explains, I tried to think of the most inoffensive, friendly, comforting thing from my childhood. I feel like they should have built up that tension, and then smash cut the Stay Puft to have him roar or something. Like, I feel like they stepped on their own punchline a little bit. Minor criticism.
I can see that. I do like that they foreshadow the Stay Puft Man. I don't know if you noticed it, but when they first get in the firehouse,
placement. Yep.
There's a big bag of Stay Puft marshmallows on one of the desks.
I did notice that.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Why is the tech of Ghostbusters so cool? Is it just because, like, in this silly movie, they made, like, these ultra... tactical looking piece instruments, like all this science looks like you could go into battle with this shit.
And they're super powerful, right? They talk about them being an unlicensed nuclear accelerator, which I don't know what a nuclear accelerator is, but cool. It sounds extremely dangerous and powerful, and it just strapped to your back.
And the way they wield them, it's like they're barely in control of it, and
it's from the hip. You're not like aiming down sights. You look like the coolest motherfucker wielding one of these particle beams, these proton packs.
I think
packs.
The uniforms is part of it too. Like, you know, like if they were wearing a suit and tie or like an Orkin man costume, but having them in these like these like kind of military fatigue looking olive drab coveralls with their names on their tags and there's pockets everywhere. Like, if you got a group of four dudes and you want to shut down any fan con, do a screen accurate replica of the Ghostbusters and roll around as a crew. You will be fucking mobbed.
We saw them like, at a PAX one year, right?
We did. And
they were showstoppers for sure.
They had their sticks out holding, they had the PAX warmed up smoking, and they were having a good old time. It's great for schlubby dudes because all these guys are schlubby dudes.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, you don't have to be ripped to pull this costume off like a like Spider-Man Superman or...
Cal Drago's over there in the corner with his oiled up muscles and he's getting... and he's not getting mobbed because your schlubby ass is getting mobbed for the Ghostbusters. Yeah.
Well, to be fair, all the ladies are mobbing him. The nerdy dudes are mobbing you. So I don't know who got the better deal there, but...
You get your share of Sigourney Weaver's and Ann Potts if you Ghostbuster it.
The other thing that I think is so cool about the Proton Packs is they look like something you could build just... in your garage. They have exposed wires. They have like these big chunky pieces of metal. They're not super sophisticated on the outside, so you can approximate
them. Chunky switches and LED and lights and in fact there is many sites where you can go and find out exactly what automotive hardware and what radiator hose clamp and what Radio Shack switch you can buy. All you can get like the fiberglass shells,
the exact color of all the wires going from here to there. Yeah
it's pretty easy. It's a pretty easy thing to do. And then like we're just talking about the Proton Packs. The trap looks like I mean, it just looks like what it said. I mean, if there is a ghost trap that works on scientific principles, it would probably look and act like this.
One of the things that tickles me about the trap is that they have the warning stuff painted on the top of it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, who's using the trap that needs the warning thing, A? But it gives it this dangerous feel. Because, you know, it's just a box. It's just some stupid thing you slide out on the floor.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what it would do to a human. I would have liked, speaking of your, you know, montage where you see them testing, I would have liked to see... maybe them testing it on, I don't know, Lewis or somebody less consequential, right? Maybe they hire some test subjects and send them through the trap.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's something really cool about it. And the PKE meter, these things, these two arms like flip up and then there are a string of LEDs on each side that are flashing in a pattern. It's really cool.
Yeah, and it's the fact that it's just animate a little bit, you know, the wings come out and do the like, scanner, it looks official. And then last but not least, Ecto-1.
Oh, yeah.
This old-timey Hurst, it's got like, you know, all this crazy technology built on, who the fuck knows what's even in that, like a mini ghost containment facility. And but that's like another funny line where they get their first call and she's like assuring, oh, yes, we're very low profile. And you see... Ecto-1 just screaming out with all of its sirens and its lights flashing and its fishtailing out. And
yeah, it's undercranked film stock there.
It's done. That they should have done that full speed. You know,
I don't know if they could. That thing, from what I hear, that thing was actually really a piece of shit.
Oh, it was like a mechanical problem. Because like just seeing that thing fishtail out of there in real speed, I think would have been cool. But like they couldn't.
I think it was way slower than you're picturing it in your head. Like, yeah, they're taking these corners and the shocks are so bad that it's almost rolling, going at a few miles an hour.
It does look. Yeah, it does look like the shit that they got strapped to the top weighs about as much as the drivetrain and body. So, yeah, that could I'm starting to see it. But it looks cool.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It's like I said, the perfect thing to roll up to take the dead back, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of like just really funny details. Like it tickled me when they're doing their Ghostbusters commercial. It looks like those amateur local commercial, and like the way Harold Ramis is like staring daggers on the mark that he's trying to hit as he takes a step up and looks down at his feet and then looks back up and says, "Have you got a go?" And then he looks backwards to see to find the mark again. Like it feels so perfect.
As actors who are actually good actors, it always fascinates me when they try to act poorly and how well they're able to do it, switch between those modes. Like they've identified not just what is good acting, but what is bad acting, and they know how to do that.
Yeah. We talked about the soundtrack. I think you had a little point that you wanted to make about it, and it's probably the same one I do too.
I mean, I don't know about all of the soundtrack, although I remember it being very 80s, feeling like, yeah, this is kind of perfect. But that Ray Parker Jr.?
Mm-hmm.
Who wrote the Ghostbusters theme? I mean, that's just, I can't think of a more iconic theme song.
Yeah. And like, why don't they do that more often? Is that just seen as like passe? Because like ever since Will Smith kind of hung it up, you know, there was Wild, a little Wild golden West? Age. Well, you had the golden age of him doing the Men in Black, the Wild Wild West, and I think he did one other where he was, you know, doing this rap that, like, but like, you know, the old school, like, Beverly Hillbillies, Gilligan's Island style, like, theme song that just tells you, it's just set in the universe, and we're talking about busting ghosts, man, and how good it makes you feel, and if there's something spooky in a neighborhood, call the Ghostbusters. Like, why did they stop doing that?
That's a good question, because people still make movies with this kind of lighthearted tone.
It's a good bit, yeah. Just do a catchy earworm that kind of like walks you through the story of the movie.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
Yeah. And it has a line like, "Bustin' makes me feel good."
Yeah, it does. And they play it over the most fun part of the movie, which is the ghost montage, where they're like, this is the, you go from their first show at the hotel to essentially gets them into the third act where like the world starts ending.
Yeah,
but you know, they're just going around busted random ghosts. Ray gets his ghost blowy. There's the city's starting to get behind them. They're getting bigger profiles. Larry King's talking about them. Casey Kasem's talking about them. They got the National Enquirer's doing stories on them. And this song just plays on their whole thing. It's just so much fun. It's a bop.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and it's a call and response, which I think helps. Like,
yeah,
who are you gonna call?
Ghost
and everybody
Busters.
Can shout Ghostbusters. Doesn't matter if
sure.
you can sing. It doesn't matter if you have seen the movie even. You know the song.
Yeah.
I always had a question about one of the lyrics, and I looked it up, and it makes a hell of a lot more sense now. The part where it's like the third verse or something, and he says, what I thought he always said was, if you've got dosed, of a freaky ghost. And I was like, what the hell is dosed?
I thought it was like, if you've got a ghost, a really freaky ghost, like it's like he's continuing the thought of the first. He's like, you got a ghost.
So it turns out we're both
wrong. A freaky ghost. Oh, okay. The best kind of wrong.
It's if you've got a dose of a freaky ghost.
Of a freaky ghost. Okay.
And I always thought, what the hell is dosed? And I never thought to look it up until we started recording this. It turns out dosed is nothing. Dosed is nothing. It's if you've got a dose. But you don't hear a lot of the us and ofs and stuff in that line. It's just...
Right.
Yeah.
I think he dosed protests too much.
That's Doth. I knew what Doth is. Don't know what Dosed is.
Oh, so another thing, because like it's been a minute since I've watched this, and I've been on TikTok since then, and it's a popular thing for young people to be like, huh, this movie made in the Reagan era, it's all about how universities aren't productive, the free market's the thing that makes money, the EPA inspector is the villain, everything. It's like, and I went in looking for those points to be made, and I think that they are not made very well.
They're weak themes in the film.
Because it's like, the reason this EPA inspector is an asshole is not because he's inspecting them and doing his job, which I was on board with him for the first two appearances that he made. And then through the second one, he's forcing his way into the building, and he's wanting to shut all this stuff down. I'm still on the board. But when your electrical expert goes up that panel is like, I don't know, man, this is some wild shit. I've never seen it before. That's where you got to get some experts. That's where you got to get a containment thing put into place. Like, this guy is like clearly motivated on not on any care for the environment, but on his personal power.
Mm-hmm. Which, it's a vendetta. He was insulted.
Honestly,
and now
is
he's
something
pissed.
That we should be very vigilant on our government institutions. They should be watchdogs for us, but they shouldn't be attack dogs for any kind of like personal agenda and stuff. And he's way too, now again, the Ghostbusters are running an unlicensed nuclear particle accelerator on their persons and in the heart of New York City. They're using more power than they should. They don't have any kind of like safety protocols in effect. Like, the striped tape is not doing enough. Yeah, they probably should be investigated and shut down, but this guy is a lunatic, and he almost destroys the city. So, I'm sorry, kids. I'm on the side of the Ghostbusters on this one. This EPA guy is a power mad lunatic, and he needed to be stopped.
Venkman is not as much of a sex pest as I feared.
No. Like I said,
I've seen worse.
There's I was talking to this with Cecily. There's definitely non-consensual sex here, but I don't know what the score is when it's two demons piloting two human bodies. And like, I mean, yeah, it's reprehensible, but they're demons there to in the world. So what are you going to do? You know?
Yeah, I'm not even sure that they remember
sexual assault sensitivity classes. Yeah, right.
I'm not sure that they remember anything once the demons leave them.
It's a super traumatic thing to process in real life, but in the comedy, I don't think you're supposed to think about it that hard. And in any way, the real villains are immortal demons that are effectively banished by the end of the movie. So,
there's no one real, no one legitimate to hate here.
And I was surprised because I thought, oh God, they're going into Bill Murray and he's going to be all about having sex with this, you know, possessed woman. But he's actually gives a pretty cogent, like, no, I'm pretty down about doing stuff with possessed people. I want you inside me. It sounds like you got at least two people in there already.
It's a little crowded, yeah.
Which is a great, great line. And he's like, he instantly goes from sex pest to like visibly uncomfortable trying to get himself out of the situation, which, yeah, like for 1984, not bad.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Where do you stand on Rick Moranis?
I've seen the Shrunk series. I don't even know what you call it at this point, but Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Honey, I Shrunk Myself, Honey, I Shrunk My
Dick. Honey,
I Blew
Up the Kids, I think you did.
Honey, I Blew the Kids. Blew Up the Kids. I've seen all those, and I remember liking him, but it has been decades since I've seen one of those.
I've seen that. I've seen those. I've seen Strange Brew. What's the other one that I can remember seeing him in? Oh yeah, Little Shop.
Yeah.
I think he's so he reminds me of like a 1980s Danny McBride.
Danny like, McBride. And he's a character actor that does this thing.
You get Danny McBride in your script because you want a certain thing done.
Okay. Okay. I see that.
And Rick Moranis is going to show up and he's going to do that thing. And I think that that's essentially, yeah, he had, you know, I guess a Rowan Atkins type. He's got a thing that he does and you get him on set and he does that thing. But that's all I've ever seen him do. I've seen him do it with a Canadian accent. I've seen him doing slightly smarter as a scientist dad. I've seen him as slightly dumber as this high-functioning autistic bookkeeper or accountant. But like, it's always this kind of like, this guy is like more the name's got a Moranis. He's a moron, you know. Rick is moron. Moranis. That's his shtick. He's just a terrifically dumb guy. He plays Barney Rubble. Another one where he's just a big fucking idiot. Oh,
across from John Good. Really?
Isn't he? The one?
He probably is. I saw that movie once a long time ago.
I thought so. I'm going off of my ass on that one. But yeah, Rick Moranis, Barney Rubble.
All right. Nice. Yeah, you're 100% right. He does exactly one thing in everything I've seen him in. And it's a good thing. I mean, you need people like that, right?
Yeah.
I enjoy a lot of Danny McBride stuff, too. But yeah, sure. You're right. They're there to do the thing they do.
Yeah.
Which is also true of Bill Murray. I mean, even the higher profile people in here, Bill Murray does the thing that Bill Murray does.
Uh-huh.
I've seen him reach dramatically, and that has occasionally worked for me.
Sure.
Lost in Translation, Broken Flowers, things like that. But he's still always just, he's Bill Murray. You hire Bill Murray because he's Bill Murray.
Yeah, if you wanted, you wanted a good character actor, get Paul Giamatti, you know. But if you want,
right, if you want the guy who can do billions,
flavor of character actor,
and unlike Sigourney Weaver, who's actually an actor, who's not just a very funny person who does this one thing. She's stretching in this movie.
She sells the shit out of that demon possession. The things she's doing with like her neck and her joints and her feet. In fact I should look it up. They might have put in some kind of inflatable things in her neck, because like the way her neck kind of bulges and stretches as she's levitating is legitimately creepy. She goes from like 10 out of 10 sex pot to like would not touch with a 10-foot crucifix in like 3 seconds. And it's all just her physical acting. Like, that's wrong. That's some exorcist shit. You need a Catholic priest to tap that.
Yeah, I'm with you. She's great in this movie.
Why is Janine so into Egon? I feel like there's some cut scenes that explain her fascination for Egon.
I mean, I got that they're just both huge nerds in their own ways, right? He's like the science nerd. She's the book nerd. But they kindred spirits in that regard. But
and he's like,
I don't know otherwise.
It's not like fucking a 7-year-old boy like it would be for Dan Aykroyd. So she's like, okay, Egon at least reads as a man. But there's nothing like when his first scenery pops up under his desk. He's not like, that's just him working on her computer, right?
Do they ever actually kiss in this movie?
I don't think so.
It's just Bill Murray and Sigourney Weaver.
Weaver, yeah.
But I don't think they do at the end. So yeah, it's that weird like energy, but never, it doesn't ever manifest. And so I think
like
when you see that,
Pee-wee Herman. The like, Pee Wee Herman aspect where it's like he understands he's hitting on her, but he's like doesn't know what to do with it. Like, come on, Dottie, I'm a loner. I'm a rebel.
Yeah, there's something there that I think they're both kind of acknowledging, but maybe he's too nerdy to really act on anything.
What else do we want to? What else we got? There's just a bunch of random stuff I can talk about.
Well, I like like I said earlier, the way they kind of tie the events of this into the story. Because, like, when the gargoyles start breaking out of the top of this building, I'm like, wait a second. You built a building in, I don't know, 1910, whatever, whenever this building was made. You built this building with these gargoyle statues Did you know there were demons inside? What, like, are the people who built this evil? And yeah, it actually turns out they were trying to create some focal point for the demon to come through. I thought that all tied together pretty surprisingly well.
It's shockingly well constructed for a dumb 80s comedy. Because all the things where you started being like, geez, it's real convenient that Ghostbusters started their ghostbusting at a time of record paranormal activity. But yeah, they got this idea that like after World War One, this kind of like hippie sex cult demon worshippers decided that the whole world needed to go. So they had an eccentric millionaire investor that built this building with all these exotic materials to like to focus and refine psychic distress and all this other stuff. And the only thing that that doesn't check out for me is why in the ensuing years between 1920 and 1984 did the psychic distress not get to a level, like not during the height of World War II.
What was the inciting event here? Yeah.
Not during the Cuban Missile Crisis with so much fear in the large cities and the Atlantic the seaboard. Not during the
Vietnam
War. You
needed Gordon Gekko to say greed is good. And then it was like, oh yeah, we need to burn this down. This is our moment, guys. We're demons. Let's get out there and do our thing.
You needed a critical mass of Wall Street traders snorting coke off hookers' stomachs. And then their ghosts are like, this is the debauchery that we've been waiting for.
You needed options trading to become legal. Yeah. And then, it was all over for the world.
I mean, once he deregulated Wall Street, it just it accounted for the ghost too.
Other
stuff, like, it's like kind of vague, like, okay, yeah, I know about those weird psychic cults back in the day, and you know, doing all the arcane, the occult stuff, yeah, it made sense.
They all have weird habits. The other thing I like about it is the sort of funny book ending of it all, because the terror dogs, I think is what they're called, they come out of those gargoyles. And then once all is said and done, after they've defeated Gozer, the terror dogs are like frozen back to stone. And then Sigourney Weaver and Harold Ramis come out of the terror dogs, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, and it's neat that they're actually physically breaking them out of these like plaster molds. And it's a nice tidy little effect.
I love the effects. That pavement breaking up when they're about to go into that building and swallowing them up and the cars shifting. And I love that effect. It reminds me of, like, I went to Universal Studios as a kid and they had the King Kong ride there. And they do that with the King Kong ride where the tracks move and the pavement moves and Kong's there reaching for you. It reminded me of that. It's like movie making kind of magic at its height. I love seeing that.
I do think that like you can see where the budget started to run out, because to me that felt like starting a sequence where they were going to go in the front door, but now they're in the dark sub basement. They got to fight through a couple more levels of ghosts.
Right?
But it's like,
that would
we
be
don't
cool.
got time or budget for that. So they're just going to like get swallowed up by the earth. But after like a second or two of hesitation, they're just going to crawl out of the crack and be like, you can't get us that easy, ghosts.
And everybody will cheer, and that'll give them the power they need. Yeah.
But I feel like that they surely meant that end sequence to be a little bit more spicy. And I definitely felt like they were missing one early montage of just like, you know, them working through technical issues going, because they go from like fully funding the Ghostbusters to their first call with like 1 minute scene of Annie Potts being bored. And, you know, you don't actually see them cleaning up the place, getting it ready, building. Like, I could use some, I could use some Dan Aykroyd wearing welding goggles and welding like some heavy, you know, him and Egon working while Bill Murray's fucking around in the back. You know, they left some things on the table, but it could be that also the tight budget made it a really lean, mean movie too. Like the Temptations to bloat it out just couldn't happen.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know if this movie is as good at 2 hours as it is at hour 40. But I did think, you know, the way that they, whether it was intended or whether it was a cover up for a budget shortfall, the stair climbing sequence, I did kind of enjoy that. You know, let me know when we get to level 20, because I'm going to puke. I love that he has that much control.
Let me ask you this. Is this a Christmas movie?
Nah.
Bill Murray starts to sing Santa Claus is Coming to Town, though.
Mm-hmm. It just doesn't motivate any of the plot is the problem.
This movie was made in June, and I think it kind of feels like a Christmas. It's just something about the atmosphere. Maybe it's because New York is like it's always at night and dark, but like,
yeah,
I feel like you're a couple scenes of outdoor snow and some Christmas lights and one. You could even do the scary ghost stories part of the most wonderful time of the year, and you could have made Ghostbusters into an all-time great Christmas story too.
I 100% agree, and I don't know if that's because there's more of that in number two, and I'm confusing the movies,
or if it
just feels like it. Because you're right, it feels like it could be.
For some reason, I got the opinion that Ghostbusters was considered kind of a Christmas classic. Maybe it's just because like a bunch of Gen X kids grew up watching it, and they got time to watch movies at Christmas, so they're watching their old favorites. But
maybe.
Or maybe you're right. Maybe two is set during Christmas, because I thought there was a much stronger tie into Christmas than there was. But yeah, it's just to him kind of like paraphrasing, you better watch out.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't remember
be
much
good
of
for goodness
two.
Sake.
It's the museum, it's the painting of what's his name.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Could be Christmassy. Another
else?
Question for you. Why
yeah.
I didn't understand the rationalization for the cops bringing Lewis to the Ghostbusters. Like,
Lewis.
I know they're kind of all over the place on the news at the time.
Yeah,
but
Rick Moranis, yeah.
When they see him ranting and raving, like, you know, the terror hound that he is, they're like, we brought him to you because he's weird. Wouldn't you take him to, like, a facility that handles mental patients?
Well, they did. They said Bellevue didn't want him. I'm like, is that an option? Is that something
Holy
you can just do?
Shit.
You can just be like, yeah, this guy's too crazy for the mental hospital. Go take him through the Ghostbuster quacks.
All right, that's a pretty
good
joke.
But they had the line
joke,
where it's like the cops are like, and the idea of like this guy's like suffering from something we've never seen, so maybe you'll be interested in him. And I also was pretty cool. Like when they had all this technology when they're interviewing Sigourney Weaver and they got her hooked up to spectral analysis, and it looks like, you know, like an infrared version of her face. Did you notice that when they're doing that to Rick Moranis, his face looks like the Keymaster? It's got like that demonic bullhead. His like 3D visualization as a demon. I thought that was a nice little hint of how this equipment is supposed to work.
Yeah.
I still want to know what the fuck Bill Murray's going through with her apartment. What is that machine? The one that's got like the little spigometer on it?
Where he's pumping it. I think he's like, yeah.
Is it like dusting for ghost prints or something? Because there wasn't any like puffs or anything coming out. It's
yeah. They should have had some colored smoke or something coming out of that. That would have been an even cooler prop. But
and she
I
asked
think
him
what
like
is.
What is this? And he's like, oh, it's, you know, he gives her some half-assed bullshit answer about, oh, it's very complicated and you wouldn't want to know. And I'm like, I do. I very much want to know what this is and what you're doing. I thought it was really funny when they finally get around to cross streams. We talked about how they hold the proton packs at waist level like it's a big machine gun. But when they start about cross streams, it gets very phallic. All the boys are holding it right at their crotch level, and the way they're trying to touch the tips together, it's very it looks like they're having a sword fight. And I think it reads as that too.
Didn't think about that, but you're right. I let's talk about Gozer for a second.
Okay.
Gozer is just a fantasized version of Bridget Nielsen, right?
She is some like Nordic model. I looked her up because I thought for a minute it might be like a exceptionally fierce Sigourney. Like they just took what they did with the gatekeeper and just like turned it to 10, you know? But no, it's actually, she's like some kind of 6 foot tall Swedish model.
She just reminds me of Bridget Nielsen, which now I understand why.
I think they're cut from the same Teutonic slab. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
they're calved from the same Norwegian fjord.
Absolutely. And the, you know, there's the whole battle where they cross the swords, like you were talking about, they cross the streams. Mm-hmm. And then that explosion, This might be the least believable thing in this movie about spectral entities and gatekeepers and key masters and shit. But that explosion, the fact that it does not kill them, they made the explosion too big.
But they also hype this stuff like it could like end all life, because I was curious of how that looked too. And I'm like, I'm expecting some big shit to happen. But also it's going to be like half the energy is going to blow through this portal and it's inverted. So I thought it was the appropriate size explosion, but you're right. I don't know how those guys survived it.
There's nowhere to hide up there. You're on a rooftop. This explosion is blowing the roof off of it, literally blowing the roof off this building.
I wish they did something to like, we're going to fire off the trap at the exact same time and within a, you know, a 10 meter radius, the like the force field that this generates will shield us just long enough. But mm-hmm. but yeah, like there could have been like a little bit more of a timing thing. But I mean, it's a comedy. What do you want?
Sure. I'm not holding its feet to the fire here, but it's a big explosion.
They could have done more with the world building and the tech for sure.
A little bit.
I didn't think that building was really cool. It stuck out like a sore thumb that's not part of, like, when I first saw it, I'm like, what the hell did they do? Like, take the Chrysler building, cut it in half, and I'm like, oh, no, this is like, this is a constructed building. This building doesn't really exist in New York. But they did a pretty good job. I really liked how when they were gathered at the base of it and they look up and there's like this really cool purple lightning striking the top and the sky looks like an old school Quake skybox, you know, just like this purple roiling yeah. vapor clouds going. And the two things of the special effects that I thought stuck out like a sore thumb is early on, there's a perspective where you're looking down on the city through these gargoyles, and these gargoyles are so poorly composited that you can actually see through their teeth. Like you yep. can see traffic driving that. Through them. And I'm like, God, that was like,
and you can almost see the green screen around them too.
Yeah. Like the other, like canonically example of bad compositing is like a lot of the snow speeder stuff in the Battle of Hoth. But they've gone back and fixed all that in the Specialized. So those used to be the go-to, like you want to see some shit compositing, but that was because it was very difficult, like, you know, bright. And I'd probably the same thing that you had a bright city mm-hmm. skyscraper scene, but that was bad. And I thought when the demon dogs, the terror dogs, were running amok through the city, those yeah. were pretty shit.
Specifically, effects. There's a shot when it first arrives and like runs across the street that I thought was yes. pretty shabby.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a couple like when it busts through a door, it's kind of hidden by the practical effects of the door busting and stuff. But yeah, when it's just that's exactly the scene I'm thinking of. It's pretty yep. oh yeah, this is 1984, someone just drew this on a piece of celluloid, kind of. It's not stop motion, it's just
mm-hmm.
it's a special effect, a visual effect. And but other than that, like, shockingly good for the time.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who, you know, just spent a lot of time animating a little Christmas special thing, mm-hmm. I feel them. It's so hard to match up motion. Before you had computer controlled cameras where you could yeah. reproduce shots exactly frame by frame, it's so hard to match up the motion right. of an effect with the motion of the camera as it was filmed on set.
Yeah.
And the uncanny valley there is deep and wide. Yeah. If you don't hit it just yeah. right, you know it.
What else do we have to talk about?
In the 1980s, how expensive is a 19% interest rate on a mortgage?
I remember my dad saying him and mom's first house was, because they bought their house in like the, you know, in the stagflation era of the late 70s, and it was like 13 or 14%.
That's what I
but
was
they paid like
thinking.
12 grand for it, so
right, and he's saying it'll be 90 grand or something.
And it was the thing is, it was three mortgages. He had took out a third mortgage on his house, and that last one was at 19%. Holy hell.
Yeah. So it feels like a ton more than he should have gotten today, but it also at the time, I don't think it was maybe like 50% higher than it should have been, not
yeah
300% higher like it is today. Yeah.
And I think it is supposed to represent the fact that this is probably a high risk. It's a third mortgage.
You know, totally.
They're going to gouge you on this one. Oh, okay. I got one last thing. This is from the Sex Pest era of Bill Murray's performance here. Why the fuck did he ask that old librarian if she's menstruating or not? Like, He's just being he's just being a weird, gross dude, man. He wasn't hitting on her. He was just like, that's just like a 65-year-old woman, man. Come on.
Yeah, totally.
What's that have to do with anything? And doesn't she even ask that? And it's not, so it's like, wow, I don't know. Maybe he's like really anything with a pulse, but that's not a great way to flirt either. It's been a while since I've been on the market, but I don't think that would drop many panties. That's Ghostbusters. With that note, we'll end on that with Ghostbusters. I wonder if 2 is good. I wonder if 2 is... I've always heard its reputation is it's not as good, but how bad could it be? You know?
I'd like to see it.
Yeah, maybe we'll double Dern it sometime. We haven't done one of those in a while. Thank you very much for listening to another Bald Move Pulp podcast. We've got a lot of prestige right now. We've been doing a lot of Fargo, a lot of For All Mankind. But there looks like there's a lot of pulp next year. We'll be catching up on some pulp movies in the new year. That's going to be a lot of fun. This was the result of our executive producers voting each week, or almost every week. We give them a slate of 3 movies that they can choose from. We'd like to find out how you can get on that. You can shape the content of Bald Move. Go to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can join the club. And if you're on the executive producer tier, you'll get a chance to vote on that with them. With that, like I said, we're so close to Christmas. It's going to be a couple weeks. I'm not sure what's next to tease it. But hey, man, we're almost done with the year. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. We'll see you later.